This is the Takeaway Weekender. I'm Todd Zwillick. Thank you so much for listening. I had the chance this summer to take part with many of you in our Takeaway Book Club. We read Harper Lee's Go Set a Watchman, released 55 years after To Kill a Mockingbird. And that book was surrounded by controversy, but it did tap right into the heart of the American conversation about race. It was fitting, maybe, that our Takeaway Book Club then turned to Between the World and Me by Ta-Nehisi Coates. Now, this is a powerful meditation on race, framed as a letter to Coates' teenage son. And it's a book Toni Morrison and many others have declared required reading for all Americans. Now, lots of you wrote in with your thoughts on this book, and we invited three listeners, all parents, to join us on the air. But we thought that we needed a lot more space for the discussion than you can fit into a radio show. So sit back and listen in. Don't worry if you haven't read the book yet. The conversation on Coates' book, inspired within our radio studios, is one that everyone can relate to, I think. Alban Bartley is an associate professor of African American and urban history at Clemson University in South Carolina. Alex Ragone is division director, that makes him basically a principal, at City and Country School in Greenwich Village here in New York. He lives over in New Jersey. Also with me was Anito Romero Warren. She's director of operation for Weeksville Heritage Center in Brooklyn. That's a museum of a kind dedicated to the first free Black community in America. She said Coates' ability to put some of her deepest fears as a parent into words was unsettling.
My husband and I are parents to six children between the ages 23 and 33, and four of them are boys. And they're African-American and Latino boys. And it touched a nerve for me. It was unnerving that it touched on fears that I'm even afraid to admit to myself sometimes about my children, their safety, being African-American and Latino boys, Black boys and Latino boys in this day and age.
Fears for their physical safety?
Yes. As parents, we all have fears when our children leave our homes, when they go away, when they go out into the world. I can caution my children not to drink and drive. I can tell them not to take drugs. I can tell them the dangers of being in certain situations. But I can't tell them to shed their skin when they leave the house. They will be Black and Latino, wherever they go. And unfortunately, that's a danger in certain situations.
Professor Abel Bartley, I want to turn to you with what Anita just said, because one of the things that Coates does in this book, he says this is about one thing. It's about the safety of the Black body, that the threat is to your physical well-being. Your body can be harmed, and people will forget about it when you're Black. And I think she's speaking to that.
Well, I think that was a very important and probably one of the most powerful parts of the book, the fact that the African-American body, particularly African-American male body, is something that is taken for granted. You see African-Americans getting killed on television. You see African-Americans getting killed in movies, wherever. And it's the reality that most African-Americans live with. I grew up in the South, and I knew that there were certain places I shouldn't go, certain things I couldn't do, that things could happen in an instant, and my life would be taken. And I always wondered, who is really going to care? Who's really going to cry? And that's always a situation that African-Americans deal with. The value of African-Americans has been reduced and has always been reduced. And, you know, the body is just that, just a body. And you don't contemplate the idea of a soul or the idea of intellect or anything. It's just a body that could be destroyed at any time.
Alex Ragone, you teach here in New York City. For listeners who don't know, you're a white guy.
Yep.
Like me. And so you read this book as a white guy, like me. One of the other cores of this book that Ta-Nehisi Coates offers is the idea of the dream, you know, the capital D dream. And that's the idea that white folks in this country generally live in the suburbs, live without the threat of violence, without the threat of destruction to their bodies. And the dream tells them that they achieved this without plunder. They achieved this without stepping on the shoulders or even the necks of somebody else, in this case, Black people.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tough bit of analysis to confront.
Yep.
For a white person, whether you agree with all of it or not. How did you react?
So, you know, for me as a white man, I think that our history in the last 40 years have not taught people what reality is. I mean, he talks about the dream. I learned the dream. I didn't learn reality. So as I read Coates' book, he helped inform my idea about what it means to be a black man in the United States and that fear and how that all relates to each other. I was at GW while he was at Howard. So I was in D.C. during the Million Man March. And I can remember thinking, why? Like, I don't understand why somebody would want to go to an all-black institution. And I just didn't understand. And I feel like I can listen now and I can hear and I'm trying to absorb this narrative. And I'm trying to understand what that's like. And I'm trying to see the reality. And I think that's what he talks about as the book progresses, is like what's freed him is seeing reality and knowing what real is and being beyond the dreamers, being beyond the dream.
Anita Romero, you're nodding at what Alex has to say. Mm-hmm. And what's another thing that struck me in this book is the idea of the dream, capital dream, is an obvious play on the American dream. Mm-hmm. The American dream is the story that we tell ourselves about what you can do in this country if you just try. A big part of this dream is a nightmare because it's a utopian sort of envelope, Coates says, that white people live in. Mm-hmm. And forget about their collective role in what he says is a plunder.
Yes. It's one of the reasons why I think this book has touched a nerve, and it should be required reading for teachers, for students, for police, for many of us, because the dream is killing us. The thought of the dream is killing us. And you can't rewrite history, which is, I think, the conflict sometimes, is that people don't want to acknowledge the role our ancestors played, we played in history, but we have to acknowledge it. There has to be a reckoning, and I don't mean that as revenge. There has to be an acknowledgement of what took place. And, you know, Ta-Nehisi makes that powerful argument in the case for reparations, which is powerful because until the injustices are acknowledged, whether past or present, we can't have an honest conversation and we can't have real understanding in this country.
Professor Bartley, you've said that black folks have been having this honest conversation among themselves for a long time, and that a lot of what's in this book is sort of a rehashing of dinner tables all over black America, and maybe white guys like Alex and me and a lot of others who are reading this book with the best intentions and going, my gosh, that's so hard to read. You're saying, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the experiences that he mentions in his book, I would suggest that probably every African-American has some kind of racial scar and they can relate to what he talked about or what he says. It's the same story we tell. I have daughters. I don't have sons. But the same stories we tell our daughters, same stories our fathers and our mothers told us. These are the things. This is the reality of America. I want to go back for a second with that notion of the dream, though. I thought it was very interesting the way he weaved that idea in. But the reality is that idea of the American dream has been a recurring theme through African-American history. And it's one of the things that has kept us hopeful in this country. If you look at it, even when Maya Angelou was able to read her poem before President Clinton was elected, one of the most powerful lines was she's talking about arriving on a nightmare but praying for a dream. Martin Luther King in 1963, the dream, the idea that somehow or another we might get the same opportunities that whites have, that we might be seen as regular Americans, that we might be accepted in this country based on the content of our character, things we do and how we act in juxtaposition, to being judged basically because you see a black guy walk in, if he doesn't fit the mold of what you think they should look like, then obviously he's a criminal, obviously he's a problem, and we need to search him, we need to be afraid of him. And that then turns the table around for African Americans where they have to be cautious of whites also.
Well, I want to disagree on one point that I don't think, I argue with a lot of family members and friends about this viewpoint. There's still the notion that if we teach our children to not only believe in the dream, but act in a certain way and avoid certain things, that they can avoid being injured or killed even. And I hear a lot of African Americans and Latinos saying that if Trayvon or Eric Garner or Sandra Bland had avoided certain behaviors or done or acted differently, the fate would have been different. And I think they're still in the dream that we have control over those outcomes, and we don't.
And there's an implication there that a young man doesn't have the right to wear a hoodie.
Exactly.
Or doesn't have the right to tell a police officer to leave him alone unless that officer is going to arrest him.
Exactly. One of the most powerful passages in the book for me was a mother who had lost her son because he was playing his music too loud. And she told Ta-Nehisi's son, you have every right to play your music loud. You have every right to wear what you want to, be who you want to. And it makes me sad because I remember a time when my children were younger that I believed preaching those things. You know, pull up your pants, don't wear a hoodie, don't wear this, and you'll be safe. But I know better now.
What do you know now?
I know now that those things will not control the outcome, and that they have, there's this balance that he's saying in the book, the struggle you can feel that you don't want to kill your children's dreams. You want them to dream. You want them to be dreamers. But you also want them to be very aware and conscious of the real threats out there, and that your clothing and your outer appearance and how you talk and walk and the music you listen to is not going to change that.
I want to end on a concept for each of us here that we can just sort of talk about. President Obama is not alone in repeating the phrase that the moral arc of the universe bends towards justice. He's rather fond of that phrase that he uses during a lot of times when he talks about race or violence or race and violence, which he's had to do an unfortunate number of times during his presidency. The premise of this book rejects that notion. I've heard Ta-Nehisi Coates on television answer the question, no, he does not believe that the moral arc of the universe bends towards justice. And this book rejects the idea that it does. It's a whole lot of what we call real talk. There is no justice around the corner. People have to judge themselves by a different metric. And as long as most of the country is asleep in a dream, that there is no arc. It just goes in a straight line, continuing parallel to justice. That's what I read in this, Anita.
I have to agree. I don't see the evidence of justice oftentimes in our communities. My mother grew up in the shadow of Emmett Till. I grew up in the shadow of Abner Luima and Anthony Baez. And my children, frankly, have lost count. And there have been so many cases where justice hasn't been served. So where's the proof of that? Does that mean they're not worthy of justice? They're immoral people who are not worthy for some reason. Their actions, they deserve the outcome, which was basically the loss of their lives. So I don't see evidence that the arc leans towards justice, not for us in this country.
Alex, I think before I read this book, even though I've heard discussions of that rhetorical flourish, you know, the moral arc of the universe bends towards justice, I would have said, well, they had lunch, segregated lunch counters in the 50s, and those are gone. New rights and attitudes towards gay people in this country, and those things are changing so rapidly. Gosh, that notion, maybe it's right. And then I read this book, and I thought, only somebody who's dreaming could think that.
As an optimist and a person who just tilts towards wanting to create a better world and believing in that. I guess for me, I believe in human beings, and I believe in connecting with human beings and loving them and trying to create a better place. And so for me, it's not about the universe, or and it's not about the pessimism or optimism. It's about what I can do to make the world a better place for all people. And I guess I hope that, you know, when I'm not here anymore, people will look back and say, whatever few things he did along the way have improved people's lives of all colors.
Professor Abel Bartley, the moral arc of the universe, in fact, has not been towards justice. Your reaction to that?
I'm going to have to disagree with that. I'm a historian, and I've studied African-American history for the past 25, 30 years. And I can definitely see that what was done in the past versus what is allowed in the present is different. I will agree with him in this point. As one of my old professors used to say, I'm pessimistic about tomorrow, but I'm optimistic about the day after tomorrow. As each generation gets, as the world gets smaller and each generation begins to look at justice and redefine what justice, I think that there's this movement towards, we need to go towards what's right. And I think we're beginning to open our minds and be more open to new thoughts and new ideas. And so, like I said, I'm pessimistic about tomorrow, but I'm optimistic about the day after tomorrow. The thing that I think Mr. Coates misses is that the demographics of this country is changing. And what he's stuck in the idea that whites will always be the majority, they'll always be the decision makers. What I'm looking at is the demographics of this country is changing. African Americans and Hispanics are growing. They're mushrooming, and as they become more and more powerful, and as they get more and more votes, and as they elect people to high offices, they begin to become decision makers. I doubt if they're going to wall off African Americans into ghettos. I doubt if they're going to be commanders of police forces. They're going to be hiring police and white police and that kind of thing. So that's why I think I'm optimistic that we're going to change as our country becomes more diversified, as the power structures begin to change, the power relationships begin to change. I feel optimistic that African Americans will eventually get their piece of the pie. And not only African Americans, but Hispanics and others. And I think that whites will have to readjust their ideas of what it means, this American dream means. And that's why I think I'm optimistic, not about tomorrow, but the day after tomorrow.
Well, I love that. I define myself as a pessimistic optimist or an optimistic pessimist, depending on the day. But I don't think the shift in demographics is going to make all the difference, because if no matter who's in power, if the mindset and the so-called dreamers don't come out of that state of dreaming, that the shift in power or other things are going to automatically change things, then I don't think there'll be a change. I love what Alex said earlier about this book and taking it and having conversations with colleagues and family and people in his own community. And that's what I believe ultimately is going to change things.
Just to add on to that, I think that the news, and I, you know, just want to say that for me, if you can ignore the news in the last year, you're really a dreamer, because it is just horrific. And I think the age of when you watch videotapes of people being killed, black people being killed in cold blood, and then, you know, and people trying to, police trying to cover that up, you just can't deny that there's wrong and the system is needs to be reformed. And I think that for me, the more we talk about this, the more we can, as a country, grapple with this dream and get out of it and realize what that reality is not the same for everyone, and we can fight against that.
Can I
just throw in one thing? What has me a little bit optimistic is before, blacks have been killed by policemen for generations. But what I'm seeing now is, like here in where I live in South Carolina, other places, policemen are killing African Americans, but they're going to trial, they're being found guilty, and they're going to jail. They now have body cams on, so we're no longer taking their word for it that they were under threat. We're now questioning their word. And that's why I see the optimism. That is the result of African Americans being in legislatures, being able to vote, being able to elect the leaders, being able to make changes. And that's why I'm optimistic about the fact that as our demographics change, people are going to have to share the power.
I just want to touch on something. I don't, which is something I see a lot on social media about this topic, is I do not want white people to be ashamed of being white. I don't want them to be ashamed of history. History is history. I want a conversation, an honest conversation, accountability, acknowledgement of whatever happened in the past or present, and all of our roles in it. Victim, you know, perpetrator, whatever. And I think until we get beyond the blame game and, you know, whose fault it is and who should, you know, pay for it or whatever, then I don't think, I hope for change, and I believe there will be change. But I think we all have a different viewpoint on how that will come about.
There are a lot of challenges in the book Between the World and Me. It's a wake-up call from what Ta-Nehisi Coates calls the dream, and I'll join the ranks of people far more qualified than I to recommend that if you haven't already, you go out and read it too. I want to thank our book clubbers, Abel Bartley, Alex Ragone, and Anita Romero Warren for a great discussion, and you for listening to this edition of the Takeaway Weekender. We'll see you all on Monday, and until then, keep up to date with everything at thetakeaway.org. And if you want to get an early jump on all of our conversations, be part of our listener response network. You can do it by signing up for our text. You get one text each day where we ask you a question featured on the next day's show. And that's also that your voice becomes part of our on-air conversation. Just text the word START to 69866. That's START to 69866. Messaging and data rates apply, of course. You can reply STOP to opt right out. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, and this is the Takeaway Weekender.
This has been the Takeaway Weekender podcast. You can catch all our show's content by visiting us at thetakeaway.org. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/thetakeaway and follow us on Twitter using the handle @thetakeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.